Okay, don't worry about the amount of material which is on these pages. I have this. Yes, yes. I have this terrible habit of over-preparing. And just in case you think that this is excessive, the file that I have at home that I've been collecting on this for the last week is 25 pages, so I spared you more than half of it. No, we're not preparing. We're just going to speak. The topic which they gave me was, and I'm going to say it in simpler language than they used, it was yearnings for the temple in the medieval period. Now, there are two ways of looking at this. One way is to look at it in terms of Jewish law. Another way is to look at it in terms of Jewish philosophy. So I'm going to do a little bit of both. And it's not so much philosophy as much as it is more so sociology. And because I'm going to try to do both, of course I'm going to do neither well. So we'll be stuck someplace in the middle of both topics. The Jewish people, Galut, was something which was and is incredibly traumatic. How do you deal with Galut? How do you deal with Churban? You know, on one very, very simple level, if you want to speak about yearning towards Jerusalem, yearning towards the Beit HaMikdash, very simply, three times a day, Jews from all over the world, when they pray, they face Jerusalem. And there are some Kabbalists who explain that all the prayers of all over the world travel to Jerusalem, and once they get to the Makom Mikdash, which we're facing, the place of the temple, from there they go up into heaven. Which is then why people in Israel like to explain that when you pray in Chutz La'aretz, it's like you're making a long-distance call, but when you're praying in Israel, it's more like a local call, because here it just has to go straight up instead of traveling across the world. Excuse me? It's better than voice over IP. It's better than all these other... And it's not a question of rate. It's quality also. The way that I titled it for myself was Zeichel L'Churban, Zeichel L'Mikdash. Remembering the Churban and remembering the Beit HaMikdash. And it's not the same. I think we'll be able to clearly see that there are two different types of expressions which Chazal almost immediately identified in the generation that followed the destruction. How do you commemorate the Beit HaMikdash? How do we take something which was at one point such a central part of the religion, and now it's gone, how do we replace it, or how do we replicate it, as the case may be? But let's start with the first source, which I'm not going to translate, and I apologize already, I'm not going to translate, unless you make me. Al Naharot Bavel, by the rivers of Babylon. Right? You know the song? Don McLean once had a song. Right? Don McLean, American Pie, once had a song. Al Naharot Bavel, Sham Yashavnu, Gam Bachinu Bizachrenu Etzion. Right? There we sat, there we cried, remembering Zion. Al Aravim Mitocha Talinu Kinoratenu. There on the Aravot, on the willows, we hung our kinor. What's a kinor? Right. Our musical instruments we hung up. Why would you hang up your musical instruments? Because you can't play them anymore. Talk about Don McLean, the day the music died. That's what this is. It's that there can't be music anymore. How can there possibly be music? Skip to Pasuk Dalet. Eich mashir et shir Hashem. Al Admat Nechar. How can we sing a song to God on land of strangers when we're often exiled? Im eshkachech Yerushalayim, tishkach yemini. If I forget Jerusalem, I'll forget my right hand. Tidbak l'shoni l'chiki im lo eskerenu, im lo alet Yerushalayim arosh simchati. Now you all knew im eshkachech Yerushalayim, if I forget ye Jerusalem, but over here the context is destruction, korban, galut, an inability to sing, an inability to celebrate. You have to hang up the harps, retire them, because how can we possibly sing when we're in exile? That's what this psalm is about. Let's skip over to source number 3. This is a Gemara Masechet Baba Batra. Baba Batra deals with a lot of things about houses, building houses, renting houses. Tanu Rabbanan from the top, and you have the English after, if you want to follow in the English or if you want to look at it afterwards. Tanu Rabbanan, the rabbis taught. Kishacharav habayit bishniya, when the temple was destroyed the second time, Rabu prushim b'Yisrael, shelo le'achol basar v'shelo l'shtot yayin. There were many people in Israel who determined that they would be prushim. They would separate themselves. And they decided that they would not any longer drink wine. They would not any longer eat meat. Nitapel lahem Rabbi Yeshua. Rabbi Yeshua said, I'll take care of them. I'll deal with them. It's not even so much I'll put them in their place, but because it's not a question of putting in their place. I'll speak to them. They need to be spoken to. Amar lehen bini, he said, my son or my sons, nema'i atem ochlim basar ve'ein atem shotim yayin. Why are you separating yourselves from meat and from wine? Amrulo, they said, nachal basar, can we possibly eat meat? Shemimenu makrivim agabe mizbeach? Can we possibly eat meat? Because they would take meat and they would offer it animal offerings on the altar. V'achshav batel. And now there is no longer an altar. Nishte yayin? Can we possibly drink wine? Sheminaschin agabe hamizbeach? And wine was poured as libations on top of the mizbeach. This is not talking about Tisha B'Av, and it's not talking about Erev Tisha B'Av. It's not talking about the 9 days. This is talking about, as far as they're concerned, a permanent cessation of eating meat and drinking wine, for how could we ever possibly celebrate again? The temple is destroyed. This is how people felt. This was what I would say many people, not all people. I don't even know if many people means a majority of people. I suspect it doesn't mean. I think it really means is there's a strong minority of people who are saying we can never eat meat and never drink wine again. We can never celebrate again. There is no longer celebration. Why? The temple's destroyed. No? Are they right or are they wrong? It's how they feel. How can you deal with it's how they feel? This is how they feel. You can't tell them their feelings are not authentic. These are their feelings. Our custom today of not eating meat, drinking wine during the 9 days, the Talmud says is that you can't eat meat or drink wine by the Sudim of Seket. That's what it says in the Halakha, just the Sudim of Seket. When we sit on the floor and eat an egg and ashes, that's when you can't eat meat or wine. We stretch it out to 9 days. The Sfaradim stretch it out to Shavuot Shachalbo Tisha B'Av, the week of Tisha B'Av. Excuse me?
Depends where you're from.
Correct. I'm saying, but that's the Mechaber's position. What they wanted to say, never. Which really means a perpetual state of mourning. I think all of us appreciate that when you lose someone, you say to yourself, I can never forget them, and life is not just going to go on, and there's going to be something which is missing. It's going to create a vacuum. It's going to create something which just can't be healed. And then time goes on. This generation of people who saw the temple, lost the temple, said, this is something we can never forget. So, the conversation then continues. Rabbi Yeshua then continues with them and says as follows. Amar lehem imkain, if that's the case, lechem lo nochal. You shouldn't be eating bread. Shekvar batlu minachot, because bread was also used in the Beit HaMikdash. If Shabar Peirot, how can you possibly use fruit? Right? Bikurim was brought over to the Beit HaMikdash. Peirot lo nechal shekvar batlu bikurim. If Shabar Peirot acherim, how can we possibly drink eat other fruit? Mayim lo nishteh, we shouldn't drink water. Shekvar batel nisuch mayim, because they also used water in the Beit HaMikdash. So therefore, don't just get rid of meat and wine. Now the truth is, we say ein simcha ela basar v'yayin. We say that real joy is only with basar v'yayin, which is the reason you don't eat it during the 9 days. But he said, why stop there? Let's get rid of water. Let's get rid of fruits. Let's get rid of bread. Let's get rid of all kinds of things because it was used in the Beit HaMikdash. Shatku, they were silent. They didn't know what to say. For me to tell you that you shouldn't mourn at all is impossible. He goes, on the one hand, you can't not mourn at all. He goes, look what happened. On the other hand, we can't mourn too much. You can't make a law unless most of the people are able to accept it. This is the principle of rabbinic law. The rabbis have no right to make a rabbinic law unless most people are able to handle it. You don't make a law which from the beginning is not going to be followed, because what's the purpose in that? So one needs to find balance. He then says, where it's underlined the next line, Ela kach amru chachamim, this is what the sages said to do. Sad Adam et Beito, which is really the context here in Baba Batra. If a person paints their home, Bisid, Umeshayer bo Devar Mu'at, don't paint the whole house, leave over a little bit which is not painted. Ukama, Amr of Yosef, Amma al Amma, leave an Amma al Amma open which is not painted. The way my painter painted, this is not a problem. The whole thing, actually, with my Kablan, the whole thing was Zechel Lechorban, but. Amar Rav Chista, where should you put this? Keneged HaPetach. By the way, there is a big machlok at what Keneged HaPetach means. If Keneged HaPetach means on top of the door, or if Keneged HaPetach means opposite of the door. As I said, there is a machloket between it. But this, by the way, is a halacha. It is brought down that a person should leave Amma al Amma, which means you go on with your life, you build homes, you paint the homes, you make the homes beautiful. But what do you do? You leave one little part, which is a memory, which is that there's a problem. There is a korban. Osa adam kol tzarchei seuda. A person makes meals, makes a beautiful celebration. Mashir dav mu'at. But a person, you don't serve everything. You have something missing. Mayhi, amar papa, kase d'harnas. It's a type of a fish dish. You don't serve everything. And I just heard about some fairly famous rabbi in America when he made his daughter's wedding, and if you ever want to save money on the wedding, something to think about, that when they got time for the dessert, he stood up and said that we were going to serve dessert, but Zeche L'Chorban, we're not serving the dessert, right?
Oh, that was very clever.
I think he was sincere.
But it was very clever.
Some rabbis are smart. No, so there you go. We were going to serve the main course, but you know, but it's not the main course. The main course is not the problem. For the problem is the dessert is this extra luxury. You leave something out. Something which should have been there is left out. Just like you leave the Amma al Amma, which should have been completed, it's left out. It says the same thing about jewelry. Isha, a woman should wear all the jewelry, but you leave out a little bit of jewelry. I'm sure you don't want to hear about that. It goes on to say, I'm a Rav Batzada. Shenemar imesh kachech Yerushalayim tishkach yimini tidvak loshoni lechiki mai al rosh simchati. I'm Rav Yitzchak ze afar maklash b'rosh chatanim. That when people get married, there is a custom, which the Gemara tells us, that you put ashes on the forehead of the chatan. I'm sure by most weddings this isn't done, correct? By my wedding we did it. The Salvechiks did it because the Rambam writes it down. And it is brought in the Shulchan Aruch as well. Omer le'Rav Papa la'abaye. What?
Why not?
The women are leaving out the jewelry.
Oh. Like, but at a wedding you can't wear jewelry that line.
That's a custom. That's a much, much later custom. And over here, by the way, the reason over here is that it's specifically b'makom tefillin. Shenemar l'sum l'avlei tziyon l'tet lehem pe'er tachat afar. V'kol hamitabela Yerushalayim zocha v'ro'a b'simchata. Whoever mourns Jerusalem will merit to see its joy. Shenemar simchu et Yerushalayim v'chulei. Tanya Amar Rabbi Shmuel ben Elisha. Rabbi Shmuel ben Elisha said, Miyom shecharev beit ha-mikdash din hu shenigzar al atzmeinu shelo lachol basar v'shelo l'shtot yayin. Rabbi Shmuel ben Elisha, anyone know who he was? Well, there were two people named Yishmael ben Elisha. They were a grandfather and a grandson. One of them was the Kohen Gadol. The other one was the grandson of the Kohen Gadol. I suspect this was the grandson. But what does he say? He goes, you want to know the truth? The day the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, and as far as I know, his grandfather was the last Kohen Gadol. He was murdered. He was one of the Asar Harugei Malchut. He goes, as far as the truth goes, from the day that the Churban took place, Dinhu, what's really the law? It's true. We shouldn't eat meat or drink wine anymore. We don't make gzera. We don't make laws unless most people can do it. Which means, what is he admitting over here? He goes, these people that felt that way, they were right to feel that way. Even though Rabbi Yeshua had to get up and calm them down and say, listen, you can't live your life that way in perpetual mourning. At some point you need to move on, but you can't completely ignore it, and there needs to be some kind of memory. All of this I would call as laws, which are zecher l'chorban. These are all laws of things that we do to remember the Churban. These are not laws of zecher l'mikdash. These are all laws to remember the mourning that took place. The second to last line where it says, whoever mourns for Jerusalem will merit to see it built up, I think is a little problematic, because many, many people mourned for Jerusalem over the years and they didn't see it. The Tosefta, in source number 2, has the rest of this discussion, which I cut out because we just saw it from the Gemara, which is a little bit more authoritative. It says, Kol hamitablim aleha ba'olam hazeh smechim ima la'olam haba. So it's interesting over here, it made it a little different, but it made it very clear that where is the celebration going to take place? Ba'olam haba, which is part of a whole other theme that we're not going to go into about Yerushalayim Shamala, Yerushalayim, which is in heaven. Source number 4 is the other side of the coin. Source number 4 tells us about something which is zecher l'mikdash, something that we do to remember the Beit HaMikdash. And by the way, I'm not sure if you're really sensitive right now to how many things we do which are commemorations of the Beit HaMikdash in terms of Jewish practice. Just to see the Mishnah, I'll quote this, then we'll look at some others. V'rishona hayelulav nital b'mikdash shiva. What is the halacha? The halacha is, from the Torah, that if you're in the Beit HaMikdash, you take the lulav and etrog all 7 days. Outside of the Beit HaMikdash, from the Torah law, you only take the lulav one day, and that's what they would do. Different psukim, different laws applied to the Mikdash and to outside of the Mikdash, lulav and etrog in versus outside. Mishacharev Beit HaMikdash, once the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, Hitkin Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai. Now all of you should recognize that name. Who's Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai? He's the one who survived the destruction. He's the one who was smuggled out of Jerusalem. He's the one who said, give me Yavna and its sages. He's the one who then sets up the yeshiva in Yavna. Now once he gets to Yavna, does he say, listen, forget about Jerusalem. Who cared about Jerusalem? We have Yavna. No, not at all. He starts looking for ways that we can commemorate Jerusalem within our practice. So what Mishacharev Beit HaMikdash, what did he say? Hitkin Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, she'alulav nital b'medina, outside of the Beit HaMikdash, shiv'a, all 7 days, zech l'mikdash. She'yom anef kulo asur, which I'll leave out for now. Which means what he is saying is that even though the custom was, out of the Beit HaMikdash, you only take the lulav one day, he said that we'll take it outside all 7 days. Absolutely, this is a din d'rabbanan. Absolutely, the reason for this is Zeichel Mikdash. But by the way, a year that the first day of Sukkot comes out on Shabbat, what happens? You don't take it the first day. What happens that year? There is no mitzvah lulav and etrog from the Torah. What else happens that year, consequently? The prices on lulav and etrogim go down. Why? Because people will pay less. And I'll explain to you why this is. Because there are certain things with the lulav and etrog which, if it's a Torah law, are required. But there are certain things, if it's a rabbinic law, that we can be a little bit more lenient about, so you don't need as fancy as an etrog or lulav. And I'm saying there's certain objective problems with a lulav and etrog which are not good the first day, which are good for the other days. But over here, now you realize what's the difference the other days. The truth is we shouldn't even take it the other day. The only day we should take a lulav and etrog is the first day. But why do we do this? Zecher l'mikdash, not zecher l'chorban, zecher l'mikdash, which means, again, it's a very interesting balance. Some things we do to remember the terrible calamity of the destruction, and that's this incompletion that we should sense in our lives. Other things we do in order to remember that there was once a Beit HaMikdash. Let me show you a list. And this is done simply enough in source number 6 by looking in the Encyclopedia Talmudit, which has an entrance under Beit HaMikdash and under Zeichel HaMikdash. Takanot Shonot Tiknu Chachamim Mishom Zeichel HaMikdash. We have all kinds of laws which the rabbis enacted in order to remember the Beit HaMikdash. The Gemara says, "Minayin she'osim zecher mikdash," and it quotes a pasuk, "Tzion hidoresh ein la." There's a complaint in the Navi. Nobody is being doresh Tzion. So it says, if no one's being doresh Tzion, what do we learn from the complaint? That somebody should be doresh Tzion. How do things have to be doresh Tzion? Doresh normally means to look for, to search out. So it says we should be searching out Tzion, Zion, the Beit HaMikdash in our lives. So how so? All kinds of laws, Zeichel HaMikdash. The first one there is Lulav. You see bolded in the second paragraph on page 3. The next one, Nagu Yisrael b'chol makomot laniach b'chatzot teva be'emtza beit ha'kneset u'mekifim ota b'chol yom k'derech she'mekifim et b'zreich Zeichel HaMikdash. What's that? Hakafot. That they do with the Lulav and Etrog for the 7 days of Sukkot to go around the Bima. That's Zeichel HaMikdash. It's not a halacha which really belonged in a shul. It belonged in the Beit HaMikdash. Next one, Nitilat Arava b'Shvi'i shel Chag Sukkot, on Hoshana Rabbah, to take the Aravot. That's also something straight from the Beit HaMikdash. It's law which we took from the Beit HaMikdash and took it outside. Next paragraph. L'zecher ha'nesh ha'naseh b'mikdash b'adlakat ha'neiro b'yimei ha'chashmonaim t'knu shmonat yimei chanukah u'lalik b'hen neirot v'nahagu l'alik b'beit ha'kneset b'kotel darom zecher l'mikdash. All of you know that when you light your candles at home, you light them by the window, right? In a shul, right? You light them by the window? No? What do you light it outside?
No. Oh, you told Hanukkah.
Hanukkah.
Oh, by the window.
By the window, right.
Oh,
right, by the window. You all light it by the window, right?
Mm-hmm.
Even though that's a very strange thing to do. The original halacha was to light it outside. Outside by the entrance to your house or entrance to your property. It's machlok at Rashi and Tosfot. The reason it was lit inside was because of danger. It was dangerous to light it outside. What the danger was, was anti-Semitism, was somebody would steal it, or it was cold. You have all kinds of different authorities. In the shul, where do you light it? So the halacha in the shul, you light it by the south wall. Why? What? Because that's where the candles, that's where in the Beit HaMikdash stood. So therefore, this, meaning, why you light it in your house? Mitzvah Chanukah, Ner Ishu Veito. What's the mitzvah of Ner Chanukah? For each home, each household. Why are you lighting it in the shul? One reason, Zeichel HaMikdash. Parshat Shkalim, we read Zeichel HaMikdash. Achilat Maror. Bizman Hazeh is Zecher LeMikdash. Or I would say the most famous Zecher LeMikdash is what Hillel would do. Zecher LeMikdash KeHillel. Right? When Hillel would put the matzah, the maror, the sandwich together. Svirat HaOmer Bizman Hazeh is Zecher LeMikdash. All of these things. Again, as I said, you I think are surprised because you know the Jews do all these things. We don't always remember exactly why we do these things. All of these things are either things that were done in the Beit HaMikdash. Normally, you would say you don't take practice from the Mikdash and take it out of the Mikdash. You don't take a korban that you used to do in the Mikdash and take it into your backyard. Right? That's obviously was not going to be done. But what Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai looked for was how can we find Jewish practice, which is not exactly doing a korban, how can we do a Jewish practice that will keep the Beit HaMikdash alive in our minds and keep the practice? The whole idea of Simchat Beit HaShoeva is clearly something which is done Zecher LeMikdash. So again, we saw a balance over here between two different things, right? Certain things we do to remember the mourning, not to let the mourning escape us. Certain things which we would then label Zecher LeChorban. And there are certain things that we do, Zecher LeMikdash. Some things to remember the destruction, some things to remember that there was a Beit HaMikdash. Now, having said that, the other famous thing which we do, Zecher LeChorban, is probably the most famous. What is it? So I was talking before about weddings.
Glass.
Right, the glass. Where does that come from?
To remember.
Huh?
To remember.
But what's the origin? How far back? So how far back is the origin of that practice of breaking the glass? Where does it come from? So if we look, second, there's a Gemara in Brachot. It's on page 4 on the bottom, source number 9. By the way, all the things I told you before about Zecher LeChorban are all found in source number 8. You know what? Let's look at that first, and then we'll move over to the Gemara in Brachot. Source number 8. This is the Shulchan Aruch. This is Jewish law. You see in bold, in the third line, you leave the Amma al Amma by the Petach. You leave by the doorway, the thing which is unpainted. It talks about making a Se'udah, the next thing which is bold, where you leave some food out of the Se'udah. It talks about the jewelry, right? It talks about putting on the ashes by the Chatan. And then it writes by Gimel, V'yesh mekamot shenagu lishbor kos b'shat chupa. There are some people who have the custom of breaking a cup by the chuppah. Now that's the one thing written in the Shulchan Aruch which was not mentioned in the Gemara in Baba Batra. So where that came from, I'll show you in a second. He continues over here and he writes in Gimel, V'chein gazru shelo lenagen b'klei shir. And it was also a law not to play musical instruments, v'kol minei zemer, and not to any kind of singing. The kol mashpia kol shil shir l'sameich b'hem, or any kind of music which will make you happy. Now this, I think, should have come as a little bit more of a surprise to you, that we find a prohibition against music. By the way, is it such a surprise in light of what we read in the very beginning, Al Narot Bavel? How could we possibly sing? How could we possibly celebrate? So why that made its way into the Shulchan Aruch maybe isn't so surprising. What exactly is the halacha? We'll need to qualify in a second. There are still people.
There are still
people who won't have music by weddings in Jerusalem, or only one instrument. They'll have drums. They won't have anything else.
Well, they don't have them in Jerusalem, so they can have music.
The next thing which is bolded, va'afilu shir b'peh al hayayin asura, even just to sing without music, just to sing, if you're doing it with wine, is not allowed. But he says, "Letzarach mitzvah kagon beit chatan v'kala hakol shir," then it's allowed. And the last line there, "Asur la'adam shemalei piv l'schok b'olam hazeh," a person should never be all that happy in this world. Since the Chorban, you can't fill your mouth with laughter. Okay, let me just mention about this wine and, excuse me, about the music and so on. Lehalacha, and I'm saying this halacha lemaase, I'm a rabbi, I'm allowed to say this, even though you never heard this halacha before, it is here. And the limitation is as follows. If it's a Sudat Mitzvah, any type of Sudat Mitzvah, then there's no problem. So you just now included any kind of bar mitzvah, wedding, bat mitzvah, pidyon haben, brit milah, any kind of sudat mitzvah, it's not a problem. Second thing, if somebody's playing music, someone's allowed to play music. Again, there are those commentaries who will say, post will say, no, you can't play music. We believe that you can play music. But the problem will be playing music and drinking wine together. Wine and music together don't go. And I'm saying this halach el maaseh. So you can have a nice, fancy, upscale restaurant with live music. If it's not live music, I'm also not concerned. With live music, it's fine. Just don't order wine.
Can you order
yes, you can have other alcohol. Yes. But the problem is wine and music together in the absence of a sudat mitzvah. That is a halacha. As I said, as surprising as this may come to you, just because you never heard of it, I know that there's certain people say, oh, a new chumrah. No, this is not a new chumrah. This is something which is written down in the Shulchan Aruch. It's not a new chumrah. It's an old halacha which people, for some reason, have tended to simply not to be aware of. And I think the reason people aren't aware of it is because I think the way that most of our parents grew up, how many times did you have music, you know, and wine, and it wasn't a sudat mitzvah? That's all that there ever was. But as the community changed, and we have different kinds of eating habits, and let's face it, the community became more affluent, and now you're going to have some fancy restaurants with live music. Okay, I just don't think that the mashkiach is going to be the one to tell, oh, listen, don't play the music and serve the wine at once, or if you do, then make sure you have a Dvar Torah prepared, so at least you can try to turn it into a sudat mitzvah. Okay, but again, I'm saying this with complete seriousness, and those of you who know me, it's not my point to come and tell people chumrot that they never heard of. In this case, this is a halacha, which for some reason is one of these halachot which fell by the wayside. It's also very interesting. Another halacha that I didn't mention here, zechil lechurban, which is brought down the Shulchan Aruch, if you go up and you see the Makom Beit HaMikdash, and you haven't seen it in a long time, this is this idea that you have to do kriya. So how many people do kriya? Most people don't like to do it, so what do? So before you go there, no, you wear someone else's shirt when you go there. That's the way it is. I mean, listen, Jews want to keep their chametz, they sell their chametz. Jews want to smoke, they sell their lungs. Jews want to keep their shirts, they do. People don't want to, but it's very, very funny because, you know, I pick, let's say, a mitzvah d'rabbanan, let's say like Hanukkah. How many people will spend hundreds of dollars on a silver menorah in order to light Hanukkah candles? And to a certain extent, lighting Hanukkah candles may very well, at least aspects of it, as we saw, be zechir l'mikdash, right? On the other hand, when it comes to zechir l'chorban, people don't want to rip a shirt, and let's face it, you could put on an old shirt, a cheap shirt, whatever, and fulfill a mitzvah d'rabanan, people don't want to do it. Listen, I understand why. Tearing kriya is something which is, it's not a happy mitzvah, but still a mitzvah. It's a mitzvah d'rabanan to tear kriya if you haven't seen the Makom Mikdash in X amount of time. I'm not going to go into the intricacies of the halacha over here.
Is that like
Har
HaBayit, or is that also including the
Kotel? Including the Kotel. That's close enough to Makom Mikdash. But as I said, it's also one of these laws that have fell by the wayside. So I remember once walking in the old city fairly often. I remember when somebody there, he goes, can you buy my shirt from me? Right? I go, what do you mean? He goes, no. He goes, I want you to buy my shirt so that it's not my shirt, so I don't have to tear kriya. And I'm saying, I'm happy to buy your shirt for you, so I don't have to tear your shirt. But it's basically twisted. Because he knew the halacha, but he knew that if it's not his shirt. So you have people, no. People go up and say, I'm making my shirt hefker. Anybody wants my shirt can take my shirt. But people do all kinds of things just so they shouldn't have to do the mitzvah. But again, it's not a happy mitzvah. But there are some things that we do which aren't necessarily happy. To remember the korban. As I said, it is traumatic. So over here you have a whole list of things, but one of the things that he mentioned was breaking the glass. And it's interesting, it was in the same breath as putting the ashes on the forehead, and then he talked about breaking glass. So apparently the minhag of Ashkenazim is to break the glass and not to put the ashes on. Right? Now, where did the breaking the glass come from? So that's the Gemara Brachot in source number 9. Here it goes through a number of things. It's talking about the pasuk V'gilu b'ra'ada. One should celebrate or rejoice. Bira'ada means in trembling. So what does it mean, begilu bira'ada? Amar Rav Adar bar Matna, Amar Rabba b'makom gila shamtei ra'ada. Wherever we have rejoicing in the same place, we should have trembling. Mar Bere de Ravina, Ovod Hilula Lebre. Mar, the son of Ravina, he made a celebration for his son. Chazinhu l'Rabbanan d'havu kibadchi tuva. He saw people that were having too good of a time. A bidicha is a joke. Kibadchi tuva, they were having too good of a time. Aiti kasa demukra, he took a very expensive kos yakar, kasa demukra, he took a very expensive glass, bat arba me azuze, worth 400 zuzim, vitavar kamayo, and he broke it in front of them. Now, this is a spontaneous response to people who are having too good of a time. This is the source of breaking the glass. In our world, when do we break the glass? It entered into the celebration. It's the middle of the celebration. I included over here in source number 10 a relatively long tshuva from Rav Yosef, and I cut out around 2/3 of it. And I'm not going to read the whole thing here, but it's about breaking the glass by weddings. And one of the things that he gets very upset about is that today when people break glasses, nobody's sad. Everybody's happy. They break the glass, and what does everybody scream? Mazel tov. No, you break the glass, and what do you say? But he's saying, again, what's the source of breaking the glass? Everybody's saying mazel tov. So what did the rabbi do? He took something very expensive and threw it to the ground, and you know, things shattered. And today, if anybody, you know, but it doesn't have to be a wedding even. Anytime somebody breaks a glass, mazel tov. Everybody's happy. They broke a glass. It's mazel tov. It's wonderful. But over here, the purpose was Gilu
Bra'ada. Your brother's children's weddings, they break the glass in between somewhere.
In between?
I think in between Kedushin.
Okay, one of the reasons is that because there are different customs doing it by Nisum or doing it by Kedushin, so that would have been.
They do it because, my brother told me, that's what they do it because they don't want people yelling Mazel Tov.
Okay. So a number of the Echron, Avadi's not the first, he's not the only one who's pointed this out. And he quotes others and says, listen, if I had the power, I would cancel the whole minog. It's an absurdity. It's better not to break a glass than to break a glass and people to scream mazel tov. He says, so he suggests that maybe the Rav should get up beforehand and say, we're about to break a glass, and the reason breaking the glass is because the Beit HaMikdash is destroyed, and the Chatan should say, and I realize that even though I'm so happy today, still it's not complete. But as I said, he has a relatively long tshuva over here, very upset about this particular issue. He also, at the end of it, goes into all discussion, how expensive should the glass should be? Does it really need to be expensive, or does it need not be expensive? Now, in everything I've said till now is basically Jewish law. And, yeah, please. Most likely. I was thinking of going into this a little bit about why the materials are different. There's a lot to that in terms of being able to put it together again and not, but most likely it is connected. The thing about Tanayim is that people don't want to break Tanayim. It used to be that people would break Tanayim. What's Tanayim? Tanayim is that we agree. One side will bring this to the wedding, the other side this to the wedding. But it used to be that, especially if there were arranged marriages, and you said you're doing this, you said you're doing this, and then they get a better deal. Doesn't make which side gets a better deal. So what happens? You know, see you later. And people would break Tanayim fairly often. So there was a cherem, a terrible cherem, about anybody who would ever break Tanayim. For that reason, what happened is, unfortunately, there are people today, till today, who, first of all, some people just don't do Tanayim anymore, because they don't want to get involved in that terrible cherem in case doesn't work out. But there are people today who would be willing to get married and then get divorced, not to break the Tanayim and get that cherem or get that curse on anybody who breaks the Tanayim, which sounds absolutely like an absurdity. It's not like we have enough problems, right? We have to add to our problems. Now, everything I've said till now is really based upon Gemara. I mean, as you saw quite clearly, it's based upon Gemara. It's the Gemara entering into the Shulchan Aruch. These are things that we do, Zeich LaMikdash, Zeich LaChorban, clearly. There is what I would consider to be the most demonstrative way of celebrating Zeich LaChorban, short of Tisha B'Av. Tisha B'Av will leave aside, and 3 weeks will leave aside. But there is one particular custom which did begin in the Middle Ages, which really caught on like wildfire, and I would like to discuss it a bit. And that custom is called Tikkun Chatzot. Tikkun Chatzot, for those of you who've never had the pleasure, it's getting up in the middle of the night and getting right to that moment of Chatzot, and then saying various prayers about the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. There's actually two different prayers which are said. One is called Tikkun Rachel, and the other is called Tikkun Leah. It's not a coincidence in terms of Rachel and Leah. Both of them are considered to be manifestations of the Shekhinah. The Shekhinah is God in the feminine sense. Just like Avraham is going to represent God's Chesed, the Shekhinah, which is God in the feminine, is going to be represented by Rachel and Leah. There's two different aspects of it. That was part of what I collected in all these pages that I did not bring to you, where it's people trying to explain the Kabbalistic reasoning behind this. Source 11, Seder Tikkun Chatzot Tikkun Rachel, Yikach Afar Maklev Yasim Al Mitzcho B'makom Hanachat Tfilin V'yomar. You take ashes, dirt, and you put it on your forehead, the place of Tfilin, and then you say the following. You kick off your shoes, you sit on the ground, which sounds very much like mourning. And then it goes through the prayers that you say. The prayers are very similar to Shlichot. And so on. Zet tikkun leya. Then it goes and tells a little bit tikkun leya. Tikkun leya omrim gam biyamim she'ein omrim tachanun afilu b'shabbat v'yom terosh chodesh. Now it's interesting. Tikkun rachel you don't say on holidays. You don't say on day. It's a sad prayer. Tikkun leya you do say on holidays. But what is it? Se'ushem reshech v'nesu pitchei olam v'yavo melech hakavod. Mize melech hakavod and so on. Tikkun rachel is about mourning for the Chorban. Tikkun Leia is a prayer for the coming of Mashiach and for the Geula Shlema. Tikkun Chatzot has both parts to it. Now, I'm going to give you a superficial history of Tikkun Chatzot. First of all, going all the way back to the Gemara, we're told about the importance of Chatzot. In the very beginning of the Gemara, the very beginning of Brachot, Gemara Brachot, which is the first Gemara, we're told about how the night is divided into three parts, and we're told about what God does during the night. Source 15. Tanya, the Tanya Belezer Omer, Shalosh Mishmarot Havu Laila, Va'al Kol Mishmar Mishmar Yosheva Kadosh Baruch Hu, Vishoeg Ka'ari. And by each one of these three Mishmarot, three guarding parts of the night, God screams like a lion. Shenemar Hashem Imrom Yishag, Ma'on Kodesho Yitin Kolo, Shoeg Yiso Al Naho. V'siman Devar Mishmarot HaRoshana, you want to understand what the three different parts of the night are. It says the first one, Chamor Noer, it's like a donkey is baying. Shnia Klavim Tzoakim, dogs are barking. Shlishit Tinok Yonek Shteimo, the baby is suckling by the breast of its mother. V'isha Mesaperet Im Ba'ala, and a woman speaking with her husband. It goes on to tell us about, you know, what happens here at night. But one thing is that you see is, go to the third line from the bottom, the end of the line. Amar Rav Yitzchak Bar Shmuel Mishmei Durav Shalosh Mirav Havei Laila Val Kol Mishmar Mishmar Yoshev HaKadosh Baruch Hu V'Shoeik HaRiva Omer. What does he say when he cries? Oy Lebanim She'avonoteim Hichrafti Et Beiti. Woe to my children that because of their sins I destroyed my house. V'Sarafti Et Heichali, and I burnt my abode. Ve'igleitem lebein umot ha'olam, and I caused them to be exiled among the nations of the world. So here you have a Gemara. What does it tell us? It tells us that God is up at night, and at night God cries, as it were, God screams, as it were, for the Churban that took place. One thing which is interesting, it doesn't say anything about Chatzot. But it says at the time where there is crying. The Zohar speaks a lot about Chatzot. But the Zohar doesn't tell us about Tikkun Chatzot. And I'll just give you a little bit of a hint now. Anytime you hear the word Tikkun in Judaism, 9 out of 10 times, it will be something from the Arizal. The Arizal identified all kinds of Tikkunim. Who was the Arizal? Rabbi Yitzchak Luria. Yitzchak Luria was considered to be the greatest Kabbalist of modern times. He lived in the 1500s. His Yahrzeit was on Sunday. The Arizal saw all kinds of problems, and out of his community came the Tikkun Chatzot to fix this particular problem. The elements of it are as follows. The Gemara that you just now saw told us how God cries at night. Think of another thing. There are no korbanot at night. Right? The whole Beit HaMikdash runs during the day and is shut down at night. So it's a time that we really don't have a way of serving God properly. The Zohar, in a dozen different places, tells us that at midnight, at Chatzot, is a special time where there are forces about. It's actually, if you want to talk about, right when this whole war started in the north, I'm sure you've noticed that we read the Haftarah, Shemi Hatzafon Tiftach Hara'ah, that the evil comes from the north. Here it also talks about the north wind comes at midnight, and there's some problems coming from the north which need to be countered. And therefore, as far as the Zohar is concerned, this is a wonderful time to pray and a wonderful time to learn. You just want to see one articulation of that. Look at source number 13. B'Zohar HaKadosh Yiflig Ma'od. In the Holy Zohar, it speaks a lot about HaChiyuv Lakum B'Chatzot, the obligation to get up at midnight, B'Chatzot HaLayla, L'Hapil Tachlunim Al Galut HaShchinah, and to pray about the Galut HaShchinah, the fact that the Shchinah is in Galut, U'Lasok B'Torah, and to study Torah. If you want to look more about Tikkun Chatzot, open up the Shulchan Aruch, open up the Mishnah Berurah to the very first page. The very first page, which is in source 12, where it's Ra'ui Lakol, it's appropriate for everyone to get up. Ba'mukbalim harichu ma'od begodel ma'alat kema chatzot ki rabahi v'kfar nisfas b'sidurim seder hanaga api ketvei ha'ari. And if you really want to know the details about what to say, this is source 12 in the Mishnah Berurah, right in the beginning of the Shulchan Aruch. He talks about the wonderful thing about getting up in the middle of the night and saying this Tikkun Chatzot. Let me give you a little bit of a description of the people involved. Look at source 17. The Ha'ariz, this is from a book by Rav Menashe Klein, of Mishnah Halachot. Rav Menashe Klein is contemporary. He's a Holocaust survivor who lives in Brooklyn most of the year. He's a childhood friend of Elie Wiesel, and from what I understand, they study once a week together. And not only that, Elie Wiesel gives his money earned from books written about the Holocaust to Rav Menashe Klein. He's describing here a little bit about the significance and the people involved in creating this custom. The Arizal Amar Al Mori Verbein Harav of Avram Alevi Shechiber HaTikunei Shabbat Sheita Tirato B'Tzvat Tibunev Tikunim B'mher B'Amenu. This fellow named Avram Alevi, he was the one who put together these Tikunim. He lived in Tzvat. Uvachol Chatzot Laila, every day at midnight, Kam, he would get up, V'sivav Kol HaRechavot, and he would go block to block, Shalayudim, where the Jews lived, and Natan Kolo Bikomar, and he would scream out with a bitter voice, Ba'amar, Achenu Beit Yisrael, he says, my brother Jews, Halo Yadu Alechem Sheshchina Hi Bavonotenu Rabban Begalut Kiviyachol, don't you know that because of us, God had to go into exile as well, the Shechina is in exile, the temple's destroyed, Ubeit Mikdashenu Hayal Esreifat Esh, and because of our sins, the temple burnt, Kumu v'netzok el Elokeinu shu melech rachum v'chanun. Come, let us all get up and cry in front of God, Ulay yishma Hashem et kol tefilatenu. Maybe God would hear our prayers. Yirchem et amo, and God would have compassion on his nation. Sheirit pletat Yisrael, those who have survived till this day. Vayachasid hahut soek v'lo natan menucha. He would keep on screaming. He wouldn't let anybody rest. L'chol b'nei ha'ir. V'hayu kamim kula b'sha'ah chada. They would all get up and they would come. L'batei midrashim. V'rav Arizal haya maflig b'chasiduto. And the Arizal was so impressed with this man's piety. V'amar lava l'chasid rabba Avram Alevi. She'a gilgul shel Yirmiyahu hanavi. He said he must be a reincarnation of Yirmiyahu. But by the way, you see the elements now, how they all come together. What did the Gemara tell us? What does God do at night? God, kiviyachol, as it were, cries over the Churban. So what should we be doing at night? We should also be crying over. How can we just let God cry and we lay in our bed sleeping? So therefore, he would go out and get all the people together and let us cry, kikun Rachel, let us cry for the Churban. But once you're already crying for the Churban, what else should we do once we're already up? Also pray for the Geula. And that would be the Tikkun Leah. I'll just continue the story. Pamachad Amalei Ha'ri HaKadosh Da Ki Shalmu Yamecha. The Arizal once said to this Avram Halevi, your days are up. You've lived your life. V'tamut, you're going to die soon. Imlo Shetaseh Takana. You have one Tikkun that you can do if you want to live. V'tichya, then you live Odkav Esrim V'shtayim Shana, you live another 22 years. Go to Jerusalem. Go in front of the wall. If you pray there, you will see the Shekhinah, and then you live another 22 years. He locked himself at home for 3 days and three nights. ואחר כך הלך החסיד לירושלים, ובא לפני כל המערבי בתפילה ותחנונים, ובבכי גדול. He went up with many prayers and great crying. And he saw a vision on the Kotel of a woman dressed in black. And immediately, out of incredible fear, he fell to the ground. And he screamed and he cried, "Oi, oi, shiraticha v'kach! Woe, woe to me that I've seen you as such!" And he cried so much, amarat tzar rasho, pulling the hair from his head, adchin etalef, till he fainted v'nirdam, and he passed out. Rabbi Chalom Shabai Lavruach Hakodesh Bivagadim Na'im, and now he saw a vision, something with beautiful clothes. Bamar Hitnachem Bini Avraham, he says, my son Avraham, you should be comforted. Ki Yesh Tikva Lachritecha V'Yashavu Banim L'Gvulam. The Jews will yet return to the land. Ki Ashivat Shvuatam V'Rachamiyotam V'Rachamtiyotam. For I will return them and I will have compassion on them. V'Shav V'Chazar L'Tzvat. He went back to Tzvat. Uba El Arizal Bamar Lo. As soon as the Arizal saw him, he said, I see from your face that you saw the Shekhinah. And then he lived another 22 years. So, this is the person, or these are the people that made up this tefillah. So just to sort of get a sense of what this is. Now, there is an interesting postscript to all of this. The Gemara that we saw is from post-Churban. That's 2,000 years ago. The Zohar, even according to the most cynical of people, becomes published and public knowledge by the 13th century. Traditionally, people believe the Zohar is older, but I'm saying even according to the latest scholars, it's from the 13th century. The Tikkun Chatzot doesn't become popular until the 16th century. It begins in Sfat, but even though all the elements were there earlier, and doesn't spread till much, much later. 17th, 18th century, it spreads to other places. So what causes a custom like this to spread? On the one hand, I can simply say that as the Kabbalah, the mystical teachings of the Arizal spreads, this particular custom spreads as well. The problem is that's not the case. The Arizal's teaching spreads, but this custom doesn't spread. So there's a fellow named Elliot Horowitz, and I gave you this just as a postscript, something which I found interesting. Elliot Horowitz is a professor in Bar-Ilan University. In 1970, in Camp Moshavah, he was my counselor. And he wrote a very interesting article in the AGS Review. If you want the entire article, you can email me, and I'll send you a PDF file of the whole article. But the article is called Coffee, Coffee Houses, and Nocturnal Rituals of Early Modern Jewry. He has a very, very simple thesis. The spread of Tikkun Chatzot is directly parallel to the spread of coffee. Coffee keeps you awake. It's very easy to say to a whole community, let's get up in the middle of the night. And it's great if you have someone like Avram Halevi screaming at everyone to get up, it's time to wake up. But on the other hand, once you wake, you know, let's just say you went to sleep at 10 o'clock, even at 9 o'clock. Let's say in antiquity, you go to sleep when it gets dark. Midnight comes along, you wake up, and time to say Tikkun Chatzot. It's not the easiest thing. Not only do we find that coffee was involved in the spreading of this, we even find that coffee was involved in the ritual of saying Tikkun Chatzot. Even to the extent brought down that they had a coffee break between Tikkun Rachel and Tikkun Leah, and they would say Tikkun Rachel, stop, have a coffee break, drink the coffee, and then go on to the Tikkun Leah. And what he shows in this article, as I said, I don't think coffee is the entire issue, I don't think that he does as well, but what he does show is that the spread of Tikkun Chatzot directly paralleled the spread of coffee. And if anyone ever wanted to know about coffee and Judaism, this is the article to look at. What's interesting is that when coffee was first discovered, it was discovered by, let's just take a look on page 10. Furthermore, only one of the four areas in which Lowe noted the impact of coffee related to drink special qualities as a stimulant, its capability of driving away sleep and creating on short notice a refreshing sense of wakefulness. It was precisely these qualities which popularized the drinking of coffee among the Sufis of Yemen and Cairo, among who became an essential, in some cases ceremonial, aspect of the nocturnal devotions. Not only that, when it was discovered, and they're the ones who discovered coffee, they saw it as being a gift from God in order to give them the ability of praying at night and being awake at night. So they saw coffee as being a divine gift in order to be able to be awake at night. And as I said, what this article goes and shows is as coffee spreads from country to country, that's how you'll find Tikkun Chatzot spreading. And I can assure you that when Tikkun Chatzot begins in Tzfat, they already had coffee houses in Tzfat at that particular time, because coffee spreads from Africa, going up to North Africa, going into Israel, and as coffee spreads, this particular custom spreads. Sometimes you can have people who have a desire to get up and to do certain things, but unless you have the proper stimulant, and sometimes the stimulant needs to be external, not internal, then it becomes very difficult to go ahead and do it. Let me just see if there's anything else over here which is of particular interest. If you look at the bottom of page 11, Luria, that's the Arizal, a younger contemporary of Radvaz, had, like the latter, migrated from Egypt to Palestine during the second half of the 19th century, settling in Tzfat. There, as is well known, he gathered around him a circle of disciples who followed his Kabbalistic system and observed his distinctive practices, both of which they continued to disseminate after his death in 1572. One of the practices popularized by the Ari and his disciples was the regular recitation of a midnight rite, mourning the temple's destruction and praying for its return. This practice, known as Tikkun Chatzot, has been observed in various forms throughout the Middle Ages and as an individual act of piety. As Sheikh denoted, midnight, with its awe-inspiring silence and the feeling of utter isolation which comes upon man, was a favorite time for voluntary prayer. Only late 16th century Palestine did Tikkun Chatzot suddenly take off and become a mass rite, spreading from there to other countries in the Near East and the Mediterranean Basin. Its popularization was, of course, part of the wider diffusion of Kabbalistic rite during the period and their penetration of daily life, but it can hardly be divorced from the increasing availability by day and night of a stimulant such as coffee. So, as I said, it's sometimes from a very unexpected source you have certain results. But it is interesting because the Tikkun Chatzot really, really is an incredible, incredible prayer, which I think most Jews have never said. There is a custom of saying it during the 9 days specifically, not at midnight, to say it during the 9 days, during the day itself. But as I said, the prayer itself has two elements to it. One element is to mourn for the temple, which is lost, which is really Zecher L'Churban. And the other element is to pray for the Geula, which is really Zecher L'Mikdash, in order to try to bring about the Geula L'Atid Lavo. The beautiful analogy, which I guess is incorporated here, is based upon this very vivid image of this wonderful anthropomorphism of God in heaven screaming and crying and mourning for the Shekhinah, which is in Galut, mourning for the Jews, which are in Galut, mourning for the temple, which is destroyed, is which served as the impetus for the Jews to say, how can God, as it were, in heaven be praying and we sleep down below? Which itself is a wonderful metaphor. Which means, as much as we care about the Churban which exists, maybe it's very comforting, the thought of the Gemara, that God cares about it so much more. And maybe as generations and generations of Jews have basically been sleeping and accepting the situation, God doesn't accept the situation, and God in heaven, as it were, is sitting and crying for it. This is what the Arizal felt, and this is what his community felt. As I said, it may very well be that coffee was the stimulant which actually was able to give people the strength in order to be able to stay awake and to say this tefillah. But as I said, we saw in the whole first part of the talk, there are many, many things which we can do, both on the one hand to keep the Churban in our minds, and on the other hand to keep the Beit HaMikdash in our minds. Bizrat Hashem, all of us will live to see the day, and let it be very soon, where the mourning for the Beit HaMikdash will be something for the past, and the celebrations of the Beit HaMikdash is something that we can all partake in. B'mehirah b'yameinu.